Thaden Kanam, secretary of the movement's military council, were all among those assassinated along with their families. A total of 51 Palestinian houses were completely destroyed, while about 1,000 others were damaged, prompting many people across Gaza to become homeless.
Now we are homeless, so we have no choice but to sleep on the street. Everything of us is ruined. I am worried about my children and other family members.
I demand compensation following this ceasefire because we are living on the streets now, no house or anything. My children and their children have no home. We are all left with nothing.
The conflict marked the worst episode of fighting between Gaza's resistance factions and the Israeli regime since the 10-day war in 2021. The carnage was to the extent which drew reaction from the United Nations. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the Israeli regime's onslaught on Gaza as unacceptable. The UN chief also called on the Israeli regime to immediately stop the bloodshed. Guterres said Israel must abide by its obligations under international humanitarian law, including proportionate use of force and taking all feasible precautions to spare civilians and civilian objects in the conduct of military operations. The UN chief also censured the Israeli closure of Gaza border crossings, which prevented the entry of foodstuff, medical supplies, and fuel into the besieged coastal territory. The latest Israeli aggression on Gaza brings to the spotlight the power and strength the Palestinian resistance groups have attained during the past several years. A joint statement by resistance factions in Gaza is a testimony to that. The statement said their retaliatory rocket attacks and a steadfastness of resistance fighters messed up the regime's calculations during the recent onslaught on Gaza. It added the new round of fighting with the occupying Israeli regime further strengthened the resistance front. The Zionist enemy mistakenly believed that the time was ripe for assassination of Palestinian resistance leaders, but it was a grave miscalculation. The umbrella group said that Israeli military officials had planned to wrap up the latest onslaught on the Gaza Strip in a very short span of time, but were stunned by the scope of resistance fighters' preparedness and rapid response to air raids. The groups warned Israel against the implementation of the policy of targeted killings, adding that resistance fighters have their fingers on the trigger and will not hesitate to respond in case the regime in Tel Aviv resorts to assassinations. But with Israeli officials admitting that the Islamic Jihad fired 6,000 rockets toward the occupied territories, it seems that the power of Palestinian resistance has already done the job, creating fear and threat among Israeli authorities. With all the fuss about the Israeli Iron Dome, numerous Palestinian rockets managed to intrude into the airspace of the occupied territories and inflict their stated losses. The death of an Israeli settler as a result of those rocket fires during the recent conflict was an indication of that. What seems to be of very high significance is that assassinating Palestinian commanders will not bring security to the Israeli regime and instead will enhance the extent of resistance on the part of Palestinian factions and increase their resolve in the face of the Israeli atrocities. That not only will cost Israel a heavy price in case of any gross miscalculations, as resistance leaders have put it, but will undoubtedly challenge the existence of an occupying regime. The United States and yet another example of racial discrimination. A video circulating on social media has showed a former U.S. Marine killing a mentally ill African-American homeless man by putting him in a chokehold on the New York City subway. The video shows a former Marine, identified as Daniel Penny, grabbing 30-year-old Jordan Neely around the neck while pinning him to the ground on a train in Manhattan. The medical examiner said Neely died from a compression of the neck. The incident happened on May the 1st. Witnesses say the African-American man was loudly complaining about being hungry and saying he was ready to die. They say the victim showed no behavior that was threatening to the subway passengers. Penny, 24, restrained him until the homeless man appeared to stop moving. Neely was taken to a hospital where he was later declared dead. Penny's lawyers say their client could not have known that his forceful actions, which were meant to subdue the mentally ill man, would lead to the victim's death. Penny, who had been questioned and released by police in New York on the day of the incident, later surrendered to police and was arraigned in Manhattan criminal court after prosecutors lodged criminal charges against him. Two other unidentified people, who were also seen restraining Neely in the footage, have yet to be charged. Neely's death sparked angry protests.
Justice for Jordan! Justice for Jordan! Justice for Jordan! Justice for Jordan! Justice for Jordan!
A system that has been meant to destroy us. A system that didn't want to see Jordan Neely alive. Right. Let me be very clear. It failed no one. It did exactly what it was designed to do.
The demonstrators called Neely's death an act of lynching, likening it to the murder of George Floyd by white officers in 2020. The killing of the African-American man also drew reactions from some U.S. officials. New York City Mayor Eric Adams called the incident a tragedy that never should have happened. He pledged to do more to help people experiencing mental health crisis. The latest incident of racial discrimination in the U.S. comes as brutality against black people is happening at record numbers. Just to make that evident, 21 African Americans were killed by U.S. law enforcement officers only in January 2023. That already makes the year one of the deadliest ever so far for the African American community in the U.S. That includes the tragic death of Keena Darnell Anderson, who was tased by police officers in Los Angeles following a car accident. Those are only a few recent incidents of brutality of racial discrimination against blacks. The United States has a long history of such bias against people of color. One major example was a brutal killing of a 46-year-old black man named George Floyd, who died after a white police officer pressed on his neck for more than 9 minutes during an arrest in May 2020 in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The death of the handcuffed black man triggered months of widespread protests, not only in cities across the U.S., but also other parts of the world. Those incidents come as African Americans and other ethnic minorities are often subject to harsh discrimination and racial profiling by white supremacists in the United States. One reason could be that U.S. politicians not only have failed to bring an end to racial profiling against the people of color, but at times have fanned the flames of hatred against them. That could clearly be seen when former U.S. President Donald Trump was in office. The former president numerously emboldened white supremacists with his racist remarks during his tenure. U.S. President Joe Biden, who took the helm in 2021, claimed to be a critic of racial injustice, but he also failed to eradicate racial discrimination in the country. With many arguing that America was built on slavery, it is not erroneous to claim that racial profiling against African Americans and other people of color is deeply rooted in American culture. Maybe that's why it is too early to think that putting an end to prejudice and racism in the U.S. does not seem to be happening anytime soon.
Shock and desperation. Children traumatized. Mothers losing their children. Israel claims it is not targeting civilians, but the injured and the dead tell another story. Like dead Palestinian girl, carried by her father. With over 100 wounded, how many times will Israel kill civilians like women and children, yet claim it is targeting resistance fighters and leaders? When is it enough?
Are you ready to say enough is enough? As the highest authority responsible for the maintenance of international peace and security?
As of Saturday, May 13, Israel has so far assassinated 6 Islamic Jihad leaders, and it has stated it is after more blood. The killing machine has no mercy. One bombing operation involved 40 aircrafts and drones, courtesy of the United States. The incessant sound of drones creates a constant state of terror, panic, and anxiety among the 2 million people living in the Gaza Strip. Al-Mizan, a human rights group based in Gaza, notes that between the years 2000 and 2023, at least 2,148 Palestinians, including 378 children and 86 women, were killed by Israeli drones. Nearly 350 were killed inside their homes, including more than 100 children, underscoring the reality that there is no safe place in Gaza. And these are conservative figures. Resistance groups in the Gaza Strip have not stood idle. Palestinian factions, like the Islamic Jihad, said they are united in their joint response. Resistance factions have been relentless in their rocket attacks. Many have reached as far as Tel Aviv, or close to it, like this town, which claimed the life of one Israeli, injuring five others. Israel getting a taste of its own medicine. As a matter of fact, the resistance group's firepower has overwhelmed Israel's so-called Iron Dome system. In one tally, more than 500 rockets were fired at Israel. Of these, 368 rockets made it over the border, and 154 were intercepted by the so-called Iron Dome missile defense system. Simple math shows that this dome had a 30% success rate. And Israel better be careful. Reports indicate it has so far only hit Islamic Jihad targets. Israel knows that Palestinian resistance groups are believed to be capable of firing thousands of rockets, which could quickly exhaust Israel's Iron Dome anti-missile system. On top of that, Israel is unable to sustain prolonged disruption to its civilian economy amid widespread fear and panic among its population. Israel is now at its weakest. Regionally, it is isolated more than ever. Iran and Saudi Arabia's reconciliation have solidified the axis of resistance, especially after Saudi Arabia hosted Hamas recently and is warming up to Hezbollah. And from within, Israel is unraveling due to the revolt by Israelis against the judicial reforms. Protests now in its fourth month. There's growing consensus that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu launched the assault on Gaza to appease his fractious, extreme coalition, particularly Itamar Ben-Gvir, in order to distract from the protests. Yet Netanyahu may be risking it all when the Tel Aviv skyline is filled with too many rockets that would rain down and eliminate its presence on Palestinian land. The U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen urged Congress to raise the $31.4 trillion debt limit and avert an unprecedented default, saying that a failure to do so would have dire consequences. Yellen's comments come after she warned of an economic catastrophe if the U.S. fails to raise its debt ceiling in the coming weeks. She has also previously warned that the U.S. could fail to meet its debt obligations sooner than expected, and it may run out of measures as early as June 1. Yellen issued the latest in a series of increasingly stark warnings in remarks prepared for a press conference meeting in Japan with her counterparts from the Group of Seven G7 rich nations, as well as India, Indonesia, and Brazil. Yellen's comments came as a political stalemate over raising the debt limit was forcing the Treasury Department dangerously close to worst-case scenario, which is a potential U.S. debt default.
The notion of defaulting on our debt is something that would so badly undermine the U.S. and global economy that I think it should be regarded by everyone as unthinkable.
In order to avoid a default on the nation's debt, Congress must vote to either raise or suspend the debt limit before the Treasury runs out of emergency funding. But with only days left this month, time is running out to reach a deal. Democratic leaders are calling for the limit to be raised, but Republicans want spending cuts and other conditions to be agreed first. The last time this happened, the U.S. saw its credit rating downgraded and interest rates on its existing debt go up. Even if the nation avoids tumbling over the fiscal cliff, the U.S. economy could suffer.
They're doing, to the best of my knowledge, what no other political party has done in the nation's history. They're literally, not figuratively, holding the economy hostage by threatening to default on our nation's debt that we've already incurred.
The debt ceiling is the maximum amount the U.S. government is legally authorized to borrow to meet its obligations. Many investors are bracing for the economic fallout of the deadline for the U.S. to raise the debt ceiling or default on its obligations. The U.S. government has run a deficit averaging nearly $1 trillion every year since the year 2001, meaning that it spends that much more money than it receives in taxes and other revenues.
Congress has told Treasury, you should pay our bills, you should pay our debt. But at the same time, it's told it, you can't borrow anymore to pay those bills and debt. And at the same time, Congress has authorized all of the spending that's being done. So the spending's going out the door. The bills are showing up at Treasury, and Treasury isn't getting enough revenue from taxpayers to pay the bills. And so there's a lot of hand-wringing over what Treasury should do.
Even short of a default, hitting the debt ceiling would stop the government's ability to finance its operations, including providing for the national defense or funding entitlements such as Medicare or Social Security. The default could cause the loss of 3 million jobs, add $130,000 to the cost of an average 30-year mortgage, and raise interest rates enough to increase the national debt by $850 billion. Meanwhile, the recent turmoil in the banking industry have concerned investors. In early May, officials closed San Francisco-based First Republic Bank, making it the third U.S. bank to collapse in the past 2 months. Most of First Republic's assets are being acquired by J.P. Morgan, Silicon Valley Bank, and Signature Bank, whose clients were mostly from the tech industry, collapsed in March under similar circumstances. But they are not alone. The U.S. Federal Reserve has revealed that 722 banks reported unrealized losses exceeding 50% of their capital at the end of the third quarter of 2022. Those losses have occurred because banks bought lots of treasuries and bonds when interest rates were near zero. Now, as the Federal Reserve raises rates to combat inflation, the value of these bonds has declined.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamate began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Jafar, Muhammad ibn Ali, al-Barakat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Jafar, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, the Messenger of Allah. And His Eminence was the ninth divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet. We find many proofs for the great treasure of his knowledge and wisdom. One of the great proofs of the great treasure of knowledge and wisdom of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam is that while His Eminence was still in his tender youth, the Shia jurisprudence, after the martyrdom of Imam al-Raza alayhi salam, hastened towards the city of Medina. They came to inquire as to know who is the next infallible and divinely appointed Imam. The reliable people and those who were trustworthy guided these Shia jurisprudents who had come from different places in the Islamic world towards Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. The Shia jurisprudents went to Imam al-Jawad and asked His Eminence the most ambiguous and complicated of questions. And yet Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam answered each and every one of them.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, again, we are here at your service talking about the dialogues of the ninth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad al-Taqi alayhi salam. So, dear friends, as many of you know, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, of course, lived in an era which was witnessed to the caliphate of the Abbasids. And now the Abbasid caliphates, of course, as many of you know, was a dynasty which came into power, but was not the most religious, ethical, or moral of dynasties. And so, matter of fact, we find that a lot of moral corruption and ethical decadence and decay began to increase during the Abbasid Caliphate. Of course, this had already begun during the Umayyad dynasty, but of course it continued and spread throughout the reign of the Abbasid Caliphs. Now, in such kind of a situation, of course, and even in the present day, we find it's kind of difficult at times to figure out, who to listen to and to figure out what the repercussions are of listening to certain kinds of people or certain media outlets. It's interesting, but at that time, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam had been asked by one of his companions, what should one listen to or who should one listen to, especially considering the environment where the Abbasid caliphate, had their own spokespeople and their spokespersons who put forth the narrative that the Abbasid dynasty wanted to put forth. Very similar to the media that we see in the present day, which tries to put forth their own biased and prejudiced type of narrative in order to confuse the people and confuse the masses. And so in this conversation, after this question by the companion, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam says that one who listens to a speaker worships them. And if the speaker speaks on behalf of Allah, then the listener has worshipped Allah. And yet if the speaker speaks on behalf of Iblis, Shaitan, then that person has worshipped Shaitan. And so bringing all of this together, dear brothers and sisters, when somebody listens to a speaker, believes in them, and subsequently follows them, they are in actuality worshipping Allah, but only if that speaker that they were listening to is speaking on behalf of Allah. They are speaking the truth. They are speaking the, they're talking about the Quran, and they are explaining the verses of the Qur'an with truth. They relay the traditions of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, as well as the divinely appointed imams. And they relate these traditions with truth. Because keep in mind that there are individuals who will misinterpret the traditions and the sunnah and the seerah of the Messenger of Allah and the divinely appointed imams, peace and blessings upon them all. And there are people who will misinterpret the Qur'an and use the Qur'an for their own purposes. And so we have to be very careful, even if one claims to speak on behalf of the Almighty Allah, that we should make sure, to the best of our knowledge, or asking other people who have more knowledge, whether this individual is capable of trust or not. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
And now we invite you to listen to Shaykh Winay Keita about Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
Imam al-Jawad, salawatullahi wa salamuhu alayhi, is an interesting case study for many, many different subjects. Ibn Shahrashub in his Manaqib tells us, these are very important ulama of the earliest period, who narrate the ahadith of A'imma. Then, فَنَتَقَ بِلِسَانٍ أَذْحَبْ مِنَ السَّيْفُ وَأَفْصَى مِنْ فَصَاحَ. Then the boy began to speak. Now the boy has had enough. The 25-month-old now begins to speak in a way that is sharper than a sword and the most eloquent of eloquent words that of eloquency that can ever be said. And he says, Alhamdulillah alladhi khalaqana min nurihi biyadihi. This 25-month-old boy in the city of Makkah, he says, all praise is due to Allah who created us with his hand, who created us from his light with his hand, meaning out of his divine will. Wa istafana min bariyatihi. And he chose us over his creation. Wa ja'alana umana'ahu ala khalqihi wa wahyihi. And he made us his trustees over creation and over his revelation, wa ma'ashir an-nas, and over all of the people. Ana Muhammad ibn Ali al-Ridha. He says, I am Muhammad, the son of Ali al-Ridha, the son of Musa al-Kadhim, the son of Ja'far al-Sadiq, the son of Muhammad al-Bakir, the son of Ja'far al-Sadiq, son of Muhammad al-Bakir, the son of Zain al-Abidin, the son of Hussein al-Shahid, the son of Ali Amir al-Mu'mineen, the son of Muhammad al-Mustafa.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up? In a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about the rules of taqlid or following a religious scholar, a jurisprudential scholar, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
Mm-hmm.
little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Mohammed Jadda, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. The topic we are discussing with Sheikh Javid in this program, Islamic Laws, in fact, is still the topic of or the concept of taqlid and the questions revolving around this important issue. Sheikh Javid, may any individual follow a mujtahid who's not the most learned mujtahid or one, when the most learned mujtahid is still alive?
And that's a good question. Well, there's no problem in referring to the mujtahid or following a mujtahid who is not the most learned mujtahid concerning issues in which there's no discrepancy, there's no dispute among the scholars in matters of consensus. Because all the scholars are supposed to have the same fatwa, the same opinion. So if you follow a mujtahid who has the same fatwa as the most learned mujtahid, so you can follow him and it does not make any difference. And in fact, you're following the most learned mujtahid because his fatwa is the same as that of the most qualified mujtahid.
Yes.
So, but in matters where the issues differ, or the scholars differ in their opinions, and there's dispute, there's controversy, there is ambiguity. Of course, it is essential that you follow the most learned of all the scholars.
I see. Would you talk more about this issue? Because I'd like to ask you a question which is quite relevant to this. What is your personal opinion concerning the necessity of following the most learned mujtahid? Is there any proof for this?
You know, if there are, you know, several mujtahids, I mean, actually, on speaking on behalf of His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, because we are discussing his opinion, So if there are several mujtahids who are qualified for issuing fatwas and their fatwas are different, of course it will be an obligatory precaution. Or the obligatory precaution is for the duty bound for the mukallaf to follow the most learned one, except if it is proven that his fatwa is contrary to precaution, then in that case you can follow the, you know, you can follow the fatwa or act according to the fatwa of the one who is closer to the precaution. Because when we know the precaution is this or that, then the fatwa which is closer to precaution mm-hmm. is a better fatwa, and it is safer, it is more prudent. Mm-hmm. So in matters of dispute, as I mentioned in one of the previous episodes, it's essential that one follow the most qualified scholar, the most qualified mujtahid, because it's safer mm-hmm. and more precautionary.
I see. Concerning the taqlid issue, Sheikh Zawid, whom should we follow?
It is obligatory to follow a mujtahid who meets all requirements needed for issuing a fatwa and functioning as a marja, as a mujtahid, you know. And according to precaution, he should be the most learned mujtahid, you know. This is the central, the most important characteristic. The most important characteristic is to be the most learned mujtahid. Mm-hmm. Apart from other, you know, characteristics about from the other traits and qualities that a mujtahid should have, because they are all supposed to be sane, to be just, to be legitimate by birth, to be 12, to be Isna'ashari Shia, and to be adult. Of course, these are the requirements which everyone understands and which everyone accepts as criteria that a mujtahid should meet. But when it comes to being the most qualified in terms of being knowledgeable, then of course this is a matter of dispute, and the most of the scholars have said, including His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, that in matters of dispute, in matters of controversy, in matters of ambiguity and ambiguous matters, the duty-bound person should follow the most learned mujtahid.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Zawid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. So don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/Ian. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad Hussain, this program, and Sheikh Zawid, our guest speaker. The topic is still the issue of taqlid, or following a religious scholar based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Zawid, is it permissible to follow a deceased marja? You know, some people, in fact, follow a religious scholar, and it happens that in their own lifetime that they have to either continue to follow the same marja who's passed away, or move on to another marja. So is it permissible to do so? Is it permissible to follow a deceased marja?
Okay. Your question is kind of general, because we see that either we continue to remain in taqlid of a deceased mujtahid, that's one thing, or to initiate taqlid of a living of a deceased mujtahid, a dead mujtahid, that's another issue.
Yes.
Generally speaking, the religious scholars do not allow initiating or beginning to follow a dead mujtahid or a deceased mujtahid. A person who wants to start doing taqlid, like for example, a 15-year-old boy who has hit puberty and who wants to follow a mujtahid, he cannot start following a mujtahid who has passed away.
I see.
Okay, so this is Ayatollah Khamenei says that caution should not be overlooked in following the most learned mujtahid and the living mujtahid when starting to do taqlid of a marja or a mujtahid. So when it comes to, of course, to following a mujtahid, to continuing to follow a mujtahid, then it means that you were following him in the past and you want to continue following him. Of course, you can do so as long as you think, as long as you believe that he is still, he still remains to be the most learned of even the living mujtahids. Okay? He is better knowledgeable than those who are alive, than those scholars who are. You can stay in taqlid of that mujtahid.
I see. Well, I verify the competence of a certain mujtahid as marja through the testimony of two just persons. Is it obligatory for me to ask other people or other persons about this matter also?
You cannot ask the laity to identify the most learned mujtahid. Of course, you to ask two jurists.
Right.
To testify or to bear witness that, okay, the certain mujtahid is the most qualified scholar, the most qualified jurist, is one of the ways through which you can identify the most learned mujtahid. So if there are two people who two witnesses who tell you that a certain mujtahid is the most qualified mujtahid, then you can trust them, provided that two other witnesses do not contradict them. If there is a contradiction on the part of other two other witnesses, then you cannot follow that mujtahid.
Thank you very much for joining us, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you.
And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, where we talked about the issues of taqlid based on fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Thank you very much for listening to us. We wish you farewell. Please keep us in your du'as. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahman Rahim Mannan Kareem Salam Aleem La ilaha illa hu Ghaffar Jameel Wahhab Latif Tawwab Sami' Basir La ilaha illa hu وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
In the limelight.
A new survey shows that majority of Germans oppose NATO membership for Ukraine. According to the poll, more than half of the German population is also in favor of peace talks between Kiev and Moscow. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted, more than half of Germans do not support the idea of Ukraine joining NATO. A YouGov poll commissioned by Germany's DPA news agency shows as many as 54% of the respondents oppose the prospect, the news agency reported recently. only 27% of those polled said they would agree to offer Kiev the prospect of membership in the U.S.-led military bloc. In April, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky claimed that most Europeans would not understand if Kiev does not get a well-deserved invitation to join NATO. The Ukrainian leader is now expected to take part in a NATO summit in Lithuania in July, according to DPA. Most Germans want Kiev to start negotiations with Moscow instead, the YouGov poll shows. According to the survey, 55% of respondents called for negotiations between Russian and Ukraine parts on ending the conflict. Only 28% oppose this. And the poll comes as Berlin has just announced another massive weapons package for Ukraine. Worth more than 2.7 billion euros, the new arms delivery is expected to include four German-made ground-based IRIST air defense systems, something the German armed forces themselves do not yet possess, as well as 30 Leopard 1 battle tanks, 20 infantry fighting vehicles, 100 armored personnel carriers, 18-wheeled self-propelled artillery systems, and 200 reconnaissance drones. Defense Minister Boris Pistorius said recently, "With this valuable contribution of urgently needed military equipment, we are showing once again that Germany is serious about its support." He did not elaborate on when the arms are expected to be delivered to Ukraine. The deputy head of the Conservative Union CDU-CSU parliamentary faction, John Waterpool, has called on Berlin to allow Ukrainians to use the German-made weapons against targets inside Russia. He told Tagesspiegel daily, "Neither under international law nor politically is there any reason why Ukraine shouldn't be allowed to attack targets in Russia." Meanwhile, the German public has been wary of the massive military support provided to Kiev throughout the conflict. In February, almost two-thirds of Germans polled opposed providing Kiev with fighter jets, a survey showed. In December 2022, a YouGov poll indicated that 45% were against sending German Leopards 2 battle tanks to Ukraine. A number of German celebrities and public figures also sent two open letters addressed to Chancellor Olaf Scholz in which they asked Berlin to stop sending arms to Ukraine and to do everything instead to reach a ceasefire as soon as possible and find a compromise that both sides can accept. Russia has repeatedly warned that pumping Ukraine with weapons will only prolong the suffering and create risks of further escalation of the hostilities up to a direct confrontation between Moscow and NATO. It also said it was ready for a peaceful solution to the conflict, as long as its goals are achieved and its interests are taken into account. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera English reported Germany will provide Ukraine with additional military aid worth almost $3 billion, including tanks, anti-aircraft systems and ammunition, the government announced ahead of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's arrival in Berlin. German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius said recently that Berlin wanted to show with its latest military aid package worth 2.7 billion euros that Germany is serious in its support for Ukraine. He said Germany will provide all the help it can as long as it takes. Though initially slow to provide military aid to Kiev, Germany has since become one of the biggest suppliers of arms to Ukraine, crucially given the green light for the delivery of modern battle tanks in the form of its own Leopard 1 and 2 models, along with sophisticated anti-aircraft systems needed to fend off drone and missile attacks. The new military aid package, first reported by German weekly Der Spiegel includes 30 Leopard 1A5 tanks, 20 Marder armored personnel carriers, more than 100 combat vehicles, 18 self-propelled howitzers, 200 reconnaissance drones, 4 IRIST SLM anti-aircraft systems, and other air defense equipment.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi...
Shaheed Muhammad Baqir Al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, to hide kalame baraye kalame tawhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the life and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite dignitaries and fuqaha during the history of Islam. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio, I have two very special guest speakers, Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani. Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sheikh Fadai, assalamu alaikum to you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi.
So for today's discussion, we want to talk about Sayyid Muhammad Sa'id Habboubi, one of the leaders of jihad of Iraq against British forces, and the person who issued or gave jawaz or permission of establishing new schools in the city of Baghdad in Iraq for teaching foreign languages. So his life would be very much interesting. Before getting to the most important aspect of his scholarly life, sociopolitical life, let's be more familiar with Habboubi and his early biography. Sheikh, let's start with you, brother.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sayyid Muhammad Sa'id Habboubi, he was not only a great faqih and jurist or a scholar, but also he was a poet as well, a literary yes. figure. And well, the interesting point about his life is this, that among his teachers, we see Mullah Hussein Quli Hamidani, Mirza Habibullah Rashti, and Sayyid Murtaza Razavi Kashmiri. And also among the students and disciples of this great scholar, we see Mar'atullah Marashi Najafi and Sayyid Mohsin Hakim, who were, of course, the great scholars after this great scholar, I think. And about the life, the early life of this great scholar, we should say that Habboubi was born in Najaf. And he was one of the offsprings of the Imam Hassan alayhi salatu wassalam. So he That's was right. a Sayyid
okay.
among the offspring of That's Imam right. Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salatu wassalam. And of course, as it was mentioned, he was one of the great, let's say, social activists against the, let's say, invasion of Iraq by the, let's say, the Britain power.
That's right.
Okay. Britishers, and that's why he issued fatwa against them fatwa of jihad against them.
Okay.
This is the very important aspect of his life, I mean political aspect of his life that could be mentioned.
That's right. We will get, of course, to more details about his political life. Before that, let's be more familiar with the concept of jihad. Say, Sheikh Fadai, they say that Habboubi is among the leader or the generation of the leaders who issued the fatwa of jihad against the Britain or British forces in Iraq. Also, he was concerned, for example, with the invasion to Libya by the Italians. And he was concerned all in all with the socio-political affairs of the Muslim lands and Islamic lands in general. So an important role for a Muslim scholar, isn't it?
Okay. Some people think that in Islam, we have two aspects. One of them is religious aspect and the other one is material aspect. And jurists, Islamic scholars, shouldn't interfere in the material aspects of life. And jurists, faqih, always should think about science, I don't know, about moralities, and they shouldn't interfere in any aspects of this material life. And it is not a correct viewpoint, as secularism claims that religion should be aside and should interfere in our life. Our great scholars were not like that. Mm-hmm. Besides teaching and learning, always they consider all aspects of people's life and they care about that. For example, in Iraq, after the First World War starts in 1940, they invaded Iraq, yes. British armies, and they tried to overcome all the parts of Iraq. Of course, at that time, the name of Iraq was not used like that. Yes, it was not a country like this. It was one of the parts of Ottoman kingdom.
Yes.
But the point that we want to mention is the real Islam is a political and social religion. It's not just individual religion. Jihad is that.
Yes.
Jihad means if your enemy want to invade you, want to take your life, want to take your dignity, you shouldn't just sit in your house doing nothing and claim that you are a real Muslim. If you are a real Muslim, there are a lot of rules for that. The scholar that we're talking about, Sayyid Muhammad Habboubi,
yes.
as a great and real scholar, recognized that duty,
yes.
that he should stand in front of the invader. So this is the real meaning of jihad. Jihad is not something which is written in the books, and there isn't any activity toward that in our society. So we can understand that real Islam, we can feel real Islam in our life when it is social and political. Islam, unless this is not a religion.
Yes.
Religion can cover all the aspects of people's life, whether individual aspect or social aspect.
That's all right. That's all right. This is the real role that the Mujahids had. You know, so sometimes when we are reading out the history of, for example, Islamic Republic of Iran and the late Imam Khomeini, some people might think that so the late Imam Khomeini was the first one who was politically active, mm-hmm. okay? But so generations before him, yes. from among the scholars, they were also concerned with the foreign powers' interference in the affairs of the Muslim lands, the independence of Islamic lands, ruling of the Islamic lands by Muslim leaders, okay? These are all the concerns for Muslims, including Sayyid Habboubi.
And of course, there are some differences between the how Imam Khomeini acted and how the previous ones acted.
Yes.
But the...
Or for example, a government was established or not.
Yeah.
But at least they were concerned.
The common point is that our jurists, our scholars were concerned for that.
Okay. The city of Nasiriyah was one of the places that Sayyid Habboubi was very much active, you know, against the British forces of organizing the tribes and the people against the foreign powers, up to an extent that even today you could see, for example, the statue of Sayyid Habboubi in Nasiriyah as a person or an example of resistance against oppression in that city.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah.
So, Sheikh Rouhani, let's get to you now, brother, about the role in jihad in Iraq. Also, he was concerned with the, for example, Italian forces invading Libya as a Muslim land at that time. So this shows a great position of Sayyid Habboubi, isn't it?
Yes, of course. As you know, if we go back to the history, we see that, for example, the Britishers where the British force invaded many areas, many lands across the globe.
Yes.
Like Australia, like Canada, like some part of the Africa.
Yes.
You know, what they did